The headlines. The United States designates five Chinese technology companies, including Huawei, as a threat to its national security. New Zealand marks the second anniversary of the deadly terrorist attacks on mosques in the city of Christchurch by white supremacists. Also in the headlines, security forces kill five more people in Myanmar as protests against the military coup continue in the Southeast Asian country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. has designated five Chinese technology companies, including Huawei and ZTE, as a threat to its national security. The Federal Communications Commission said the list is aimed at preventing next-generation networks from using services that can pose a risk to the security and to the safety of Americans. The designation came under a 2019 law that was enacted to protect U.S. communication networks. The law required the FCC to identify foreign companies potentially posing threats to national security. Firms like Huawei and ZTE had been blacklisted previously under the same law. Huawei had challenged the U.S. move in court, but has now declined to comment on the new designation. Political commentator Andrew Loing says Washington's deep-seated mistrust towards Beijing is due to its inability to bring China into its sphere of influence.
Previously, it was thought that China could be brought into the American sphere of influence, an American-dominated liberal order. And then by wooing China into the WTO, or helping China into the WTO, then China would become more like the United States. And of course, this has completely fallen by the wayside. And now China is not seen to be not only not playing by American rules, but also threatening to eat Americans' lunch in high tech and so on, plus the security risk. And so this is started with by under Trump administration, but there is a bipartisan consensus, and that's why it's being carried on into the Biden administration. But the Biden administration, of course, would adopt a more principled and more selective kind of pushback. It doesn't mean that the Biden administration is going to be softer on China. The contrary may be the case. But then the Biden administration is going to target the key areas and is going to work more with allies.
New Zealand has held a commemoration ceremony to mark the second anniversary of the deadly terrorist attacks on mosques in the city of Christchurch. Several hundred people, including the Prime Minister, attended the emotional remembrance service, which was also live-streamed. 51 worshippers were killed in two consecutive mass shootings at two mosques during Friday prayer in 2019. Both attacks were carried out by a single terrorist. Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, opened fire at the worshippers, live-streamed the carnage, and posted a racist manifesto online. The attacker had legally bought five assault weapons, including two semi-automatic rifles that he used in the massacre. He was arrested shortly afterwards and sentenced to life without parole. Abdul Razak is the chairman of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand, who joins us. Looking back at this, what things do you recall at this point that should stand out and should be learned from this incident, and whether anything has changed in terms of the type of outlook that this person has had towards Muslims, which he is now imprisoned with life without parole?
Well, obviously, such a tragedy should never befell any community, and it befell on the Muslim community, and the World Commission identified certain structural deficiencies and also some systemic errors, police gun licensing laws, the security intelligence focusing more on the right, more on the Muslims rather than the right-wing extremists. However, since then, the Royal Commission has come through with some significant findings. The Prime Minister of New Zealand apologized to the Muslims, which is a very seminal and a very sincere apology which was given. That apology was followed up by the police as well as the Security Intelligence Service. Now they've appointed a very senior minister as a coordinating minister to make all the changes that the Royal Commission suggested, which was 44 recommendations. And most of the, in fact, all the recommendations are as of the Royal Commission submission that we made. So we see the direction taking place where there will be, and process has started, of some significant changes in the whole security and the intelligence apparatus, both the police and the NZSIS. But more importantly, the government has taken a very long-term view of that of social cohesion and funding, and government initiatives and education in various sectors is starting to happen. So it's time will tell. We have produced a report where we've given a timeline of what we expect the implementation process to look like, and we are awaiting further consultation. So it's a very humbling experience, of course, as you can imagine. We are all still, after 2 years, suffering from this tragedy, but out of this tragedy, we are seeing some significant changes. There have been arrests of right-wing extremists in New Zealand. There have been significant changes in terms of the outlook of the general public. As you know, it was the overwhelming aroha, as they call it in Maori, the love shown to the Muslim community, and the worldwide they've seen it. And the Prime Minister, of course, the statement which she said that you are us, or we are, you know, we are all one, is something which reverberates even now.
In the bigger picture, when you take a look at the way that Muslims and the whole issue of Islam is covered or approached, one can't really be too optimistic when you see moves made by the French president, for example, and the recent reforms that he has said that Islam needs to go through in his country. I'm not saying that he speaks on behalf of the wider public in general, or wider politicians. But, you know, it's very disappointing when you have that type of an outlook, I would think. Needs to be more education done there, or more information to be spread?
Well, in New Zealand, it's a completely different context. What we don't have here is the politics, which you see more in Europe, where the politicians use Muslims as a scapegoat for their own political ends. In New Zealand, you don't have that. In New Zealand, we have a small country where the Muslims have played a long, you know, it's a long history. We've been here since 1769. And they've, you know, by and large, they've sort of emerged into the landscape of New Zealand society, contributing. We haven't had those excesses and all those protests or anything, none of that. There hasn't been a single case of terrorism or anything like that in New Zealand. The last one was actually by the French. French security service who blew up the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland, and this one was by an Australian who came to New Zealand. So, you know, New Zealand is quite insulated, and thankfully so, because we have forged apart what we call social cohesion. In the past used to be social inclusion, it's now moved into social cohesion, as opposed to in places like France and Netherlands and Germany, where we see the national politics of elections. Don't forget, it's not just the current president, but previous ones as well, who've used this as a way to, how can you put it, feather their own nests, this anti-Muslim rhetoric. We don't see any of that in New Zealand at all.
Okay, very well. We appreciate it. Thank you very much for that. That is Abdul Razak, Chairman of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand, there from Wellington. Many thanks. Moving on, at least 5 people have been killed in a fresh round of violence in Myanmar amid ongoing protests against the military rule. 2 people were killed and several others injured when police opened fire on a sit-in protest in the country's second biggest city of Mandalay. Another person was killed in the central town of Paye, and 2 died in police firing in the commercial capital, Yangon, overnight. More than 70 people have been killed since a military coup toppled the government of the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, on February the 1st. Suu Kyi and many of her cabinet members are in custody. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of widespread protests and strikes. The junta has unleashed a harsh crackdown on street protests and civil disobedience. Pakistan's social and students' organizations have marched to protest recent rallies by Western-funded NGOs on the eve of International Women's Day. Protesters vowed to resist what they called Western countries' agenda to secularize Pakistani society. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Protesters gathered in Islamabad to agitate against Western-funded NGOs. At the heart of their resentment are recently held rallies by the Western-funded NGOs on the eve of International Women's Day a few days ago. These protesters believe that the NGOs are systematically engaged in playing with established social norms and Islamic values by promoting Western brand of human rights in Pakistan. Many of the activists of the NGOs allegedly raise slogans of protecting lesbian and gay rights, something which is deeply offensive in a conservative Islamic society.
They are foreign-funded NGOs. They want to spread vulgarity in Pakistan. They want to spread the message of homosexuality in Pakistan. And in a country like Islamic Republic of Pakistan, we'll never ever allow this sort of vulgarity, inshallah. They want to tarnish the image of Pakistan, the ideology on the basis of which Pakistan got created, on the basis of which Pakistan came into being. They wanted to destroy that ideology, basically.
Islam has given full rights to women. No other religion has given the kind of rights which Islam has given to the women. But these NGOs are spreading obscenity and insulting Islam. The government must ban such NGOs.
There is a growing outrage in Pakistan since the NGOs started highlighting the sufferings of women from Western perspective. The number of incidents of violence against Pakistani women are far less than the Western countries funding NGOs in Pakistan to promote women rights.
The bigger part of the problem with the Western-funded NGOs is that they are focusing more on issues which might have hurt the values of a tiny liberal class in Pakistan. They hardly realize that Pakistan's social fabric is deeply conservative, and they feel offended over their attempts to secularize a society built on the norms of Islam. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The number of coronavirus infections in South Korea has reached its highest level in 3 weeks, as authorities prepare for a broader vaccine rollout. The country recorded 490 new cases in the past 24 hours, bringing the total infections to over 95,000. Most cases were locally transmitted, with nearly 70% of them being in the capital Seoul and its neighboring areas. The death toll stands at 1,600. According to local media, the government is planning to begin immunization of the general public, starting with healthcare workers and elderly people from next month. Meanwhile, Australia has reported the first locally transmitted COVID infection in more than 2 weeks, triggering restrictions in hospital areas. Australia has so far recorded over 29,000 infections and less than 1,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Brazil surpasses India to become the country with the second highest number of coronavirus cases in the world. Brazil's total number of infections soared past 11.3 million after the Latin American country logged over 85,000 new cases. The country has the world's second highest COVID-19 death toll, with over 275,000 fatalities. Brazil has registered more than 2,200 new deaths for the third day in a row. The South American country is grappling with a surge in cases due to a highly contagious new local variant that has pushed many hospitals close to the breaking point. Professor of International Studies Bruno Lima Rocha says the government of Brazil is responsible for the crisis that the country is facing.
I would say that President Jair Bolsonaro and his so-called health minister, Eduardo Pazuello, I insist, three-star general in the Brazilian army, they are the most responsible for the spread of the COVID-19 in Brazil. Both of them, Jair Bolsonaro and Eduardo Pazuello. They are struggling against medicine, against science, against Medicare, and against the anticipation of buying millions of vaccines. Now, only now in March 2021, we are trying to buy the Russian vaccine Sputnik. And I suppose it's a good thing. The Supreme Court allowed state governors and mayors to buy by themselves or local consortiums other vaccines. So, for example, the nine states of Northeastern, they bought themselves, or they're trying to buy themselves, 39 million doses of Sputnik. By the way, the health minister, they are trying to buy themselves, federal government, federal administration, only 10 million doses. I don't know why. Maybe they are doing a miserable political calculus to associate themselves against COVID and spreading, the negationist, the denial of the COVID.
The World Health Organization says that there is no reason to stop using AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine, as a growing number of countries have halted its jab over blood clot fears.
Yes, we should continue using the AstraZeneca vaccine. All that we're looking at is what we always look at. Any safety signal must be investigated. In fact, it's very important that we're hearing safety signals, because if we were not hearing about any safety signals, then that would suggest that there is not enough review and vigilance.
The WHO spokeswoman said there is no evidence that the vaccine has caused any deaths. She noted that so far, no causal link has been identified between the vaccine and blood clotting. Margaret Harris said that a WHO advisory committee is currently reviewing the reports of the vaccine's side effects. At least 10 European countries have suspended the use of AstraZeneca following reports of blood clots in some recipients. On Thursday, Denmark announced a 2-week pause to its nationwide rollout after reporting one death. In Asia, Thailand has also delayed its vaccine rollout, which was due to kick off on Friday. The U.S. Security Council has called for the immediate withdrawal of all foreign forces and mercenaries from Libya. In a unanimously approved declaration, the global body also said all parties involved in Libya's conflict need to fully implement a ceasefire agreement. The top council welcomed the Libyan parliament's approval of a new unified government. Libya plunged into a civil war after former dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled a decade ago in a NATO-led operation. The UN says that there are around 20,000 foreign troops fighting for warring sides in Libya. According to UN experts, the fighters are from Russia, Turkey, Chad, Sudan, and Syria. The European Parliament debate has been told that more than 100 million people live in the EU and live in poverty. Lawmakers say social justice measures being pursued by the European Commission lack ambition. Jerome Hughes has more.
Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible, and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest. We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection, the spread of virus mutations, and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is for World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we will follow Javad Gharai, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good, long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts, Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Flat waters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Beris to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts. But I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berri's Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berri's village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berri's. The villagers moved from Old Berri's to New Berri's around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berri's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Balochistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old berries used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new berries. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Balochistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berris is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They're all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Beris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Beris cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the Kelkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. After my visit to Beris Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oma. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Beris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs that you see here are where Beris begins. Those are the shores of Beris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff. And as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Beris territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern, which we are more than happy to present to you from IRIB English Radio. I personally believe, in my humble and insignificant opinion, that one of the most important lessons any school, any academic institute should be teaching is social ethics and moral ethics. And it should equip its people with the ability to interact with other human beings in the most moral, humane, humble, correct way possible. And I think, what do I mean by that? Well, we often refer to the animal kingdom as analogy when it comes to conveying moral stories. So let's hear a short story about the king of the jungle. And inshallah soon you'll figure out what does a lion have anything to do with moral ethics. We'll be right back.
In the name of Allah, dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we start with a very nice story. What's the title of today's story? A Little Friend. There was a bad day for our Mr. Lion King. During his chase to catch a rabbit, he sprang into a small bush from where he came out not with the rabbit but with a large thorn in his palm. He cried for help. He tried his best to pull out the thorn. He shook his hand, tried to pull out the thorn with his mouth, but all his efforts in vain. The thorn began to smile at Mr. Lion. Then he asked other animals for help, but they all feared the lion. So no animals came to help him. At last the lion approached a clever fox. The king asked, "Can you pull out the thorn, please? I am suffering very much with pain." The fox said, "I am not very expert in this task, but I have a little friend who is very expert in this work. I will surely ask him to help you, but I have some demands. It is not just food or money, Your Majesty. You should allow me to give you 5 kicks on your back," the fox said. The Lion King asked with surprise and anger, "Do you want to kick me? Don't you know who I am?" I know, but it is not my need to remove thorn from your palm. If you don't want, I'm going. Goodbye," said the fox. Wait, said the lion, and he began to think for a moment. "I'm suffering with the pain of thorn. It has to be pulled out. Let him kick me 5 times. I just want to remove the thorn. After taking the thorn, I will eat up his little friend." The fox then began to kick the Lion King with his permission. 1, 2, 3, like that, the fox called his little friend. There comes a little porcupine. He pulled out the thorn with great ease. The pain in the palm of the lion was reduced, but what to say, he was very much disappointed in thinking how he can take revenge for the 5 kicks he got from the fox. How can he eat the porcupine with thousands of quills?
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So in this story, we heard the tale of a lion who... Lions are usually known for their pride and for their arrogance and, you know, for being the self-proclaimed ruler of the jungle. There really isn't any philosophical, scientific, or historic evidence or proof behind this claim, but I think the lesson that we can learn from this anecdote is that no matter what position we have in life, arrogance will bring about our certain doom. And even if we feel that we are high enough in status and rank to justify our arrogance and our pride, there will still come a situation where this very arrogance that we have adopted due to the position that most likely other people have granted us will bring us low in the eyes of the human beings. And naturally, well, not naturally, arrogance happens to be one of the most detrimental qualities a believer can have. As a matter of fact, there's a narration from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that one who is arrogant will not even smell the scent of heaven on the day of judgment. And if we analyze this hadith thoroughly, we will understand the magnitude of the situation, because there are other narrations that speak about how aromatic heaven's air is, and that people can pick up its scent, can sense its scent from 17 miles away. So a person who has the quality of arrogance has to be standing really, really, really far away from heaven and must be so severely separated from that state of bliss and blessing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala only grants His special servants, His righteous and sincere servants, that there's almost close to no hope whatsoever for their salvation. Though us human beings, if you're going to move away from our animal story for a second here, us human beings, we manifest a lot of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's attributes and qualities. Again, in narrations, we have that one of the attributes of Allah which human beings have no right on and have no right to express in themselves is the attribute of arrogance. Because arrogance, especially in Arabic, takabbur, comes from kibr, kabara, which means greatness, grandeur. And when we really think about it, no creature in this world is allowed to see themselves bigger than others, because there's always someone who is bigger than them. The only existence who is big and there's no one bigger than him is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So only he has the right to this quality. In real life, there's a hadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that says the only quality, the only virtue, which will not draw any envy or jealousy toward itself is the quality of humility. And a righteous person cannot be righteous unless they have humility within them. And humility comes from that realization that only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is that great existence whom no one else is greater than. And that us mere mortals, we have no claim over this attribute, because either there is going to be someone greater than us in this world, or if there really isn't and we feel like, okay, we're the most awesome, most fabulous, most extraordinarily marvelous human being walking the face of earth, Allah is still greater than us, right? So these are the points that I thought we'd talk about on today's episode of The Lantern. I hope you guys found it useful. Thank you so very much for being with us. And I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.